You're listening to Type Radio. My name is Donald.
I'm Lisa.
We're at the Imaginate Conference in Bologna. It's March 24, 2007, and with us is John L. Walters. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Are you religious?
No.
Why not?
I'm an atheist.
And that was my choice. Were you brought up religiously? In a religious manner, maybe.
I was brought up in a Church of England. I went to a Church of England school early on, so I can still recite the Lord's Prayer. But I decided, I guess, as a student, that I didn't want to have anything to do with religion. And so I've considered myself an atheist ever since. I think if you're brought up in the Church of England, you have a certain appreciation of the cool of English churches, the cool stone, the quietness of the graveyard, the kindness of the vicars. That's something that I appreciate still, and if I meet religious people, I would never ask someone if they're religious. It seems like an impolite question to me. So it's a conversation I don't very often have. You know, if somebody has a strong faith, I don't feel the need to talk about it or challenge it. I just accept that's the case.
Because you're British?
I don't know if it's because I'm British, but it remains the fact that I am British.
Do you have rituals?
Do I have rituals? I like to have a cup of coffee in the morning. And if I don't have a cup of coffee by, say, 10:30, which is the case today, I might add. Let me correct that. I did have a cup of coffee this morning. But if I don't have... there's kind of ritual that the British people drink tea. And my family drinks quite a lot of tea. But I need to have that cup of coffee mid-morning to feel human and feel alert. So that's a kind of ritual. But not a really severe one, because I've already made a mistake about this morning. So I guess it's not quite as embedded as you might say.
But does it set your whole day? If you don't have coffee, then the whole day is off?
The day is not as... if I don't have that cup of coffee, maybe things don't go so well. But I can't say that for sure, because there are a lot of other factors.
You're less productive, maybe?
Who knows? There's a different path the day takes.
How many hours a week do you work?
Far too many. I have a very complicated working life, because my job at I is 3 days a week, or 0.6 in academic terms. So officially I work Monday, Tuesday and Friday at the I offices in Hammersmith in London. On the other 2 days I'm involved as... I have duties as a journalist. I write a regular CD review for The Guardian film and music section. I also write fairly regular live music reviews. And I also am a partner in the music company, the CD journal Unknown Public, unknownpublic.com, and so we have various activities there, and I also work as a freelance journalist and occasionally speak on the radio and do other things. But of course, I magazine being what it is, it's a very absorbing job, and it seems to demand far more than 3 days a week, and it demands long hours, and when I come to a conference such as Imagine It, I seem to be involved in graphic design for a much longer part of the week than was ever envisaged when I took the job on many years ago.
Do you have a preference between the two, between writing on design or writing for music?
My expertise is in writing for music, but I think I have a greater expertise in editing. The thing that really excites me and really I enjoy the most about my working life is editing a magazine. And The editor's job is a very generalized one, and it's changing all the time, and of course the nature of publishing is changing all the time. So it's not a static role. There's a job description which I inherited when I first got the job, but actually if you wrote out my job description now, it would look very different to the one from 1999. And there are so many facets to being an editor, from dealing with writers to dealing with the publishers, the owners of the magazine, dealing, of course, very, very closely with the art director of ICE, Simon Esterson, dealing with this great network of writers from all over the world, people like Jan Middendorp, who's here in Bologna, or Steve Heller in New York, or Steve Wrigley in Glasgow, or Daoud Sahandi in Mexico City. There's this incredible network of very, very talented people, and I'm at this kind of, I'm a kind of ringmaster, I guess. You know, I don't have to, in my way of thinking, I don't have to display any great virtuoso feats of writing or interpretation or criticism, but I'm here to work with these incredibly talented people who, fortunately, are very keen to be involved in I magazine. Similarly, there's fantastic designers all over the world who become the subject matter for the features and the reviews and the different things we run in the magazine. So they also play their part in what makes the magazine such a fantastic thing. So I have this kind of traffic controller or ringmaster or record producer role in putting these things together. And that's really the great satisfaction in this job. It's, someone came up to me last night and said, here's the guy with the best job in graphic design. And although when I have to work these late nights or deal with emails at 1 o'clock in the morning or just deal with very long business meetings at the Hammersmith offices, I have to kind of remind myself that this is a great job and I shouldn't complain too much.
And how do you keep yourself from being subjective? Well,
subjective or objective?
Subjective.
Well, I think the role of an editor is to be both subjective and objective. I can be subjective in terms of the quality of writing or the degree to which the I-ness of something, perhaps. You know, I have a sense in which something is right for the magazine, all the elements that go into making a piece. But on the other hand, it's not, a magazine is not a piece of personal expression. I remember someone saying to me many years ago, oh, it must be fun to have a magazine, you can just put what you like into the magazine. But of course, if I did that, I'd very quickly run out of, you know, you'd do this fantastic personal thing, and then maybe the next one, you know, you've done all your favourite designers, and it would just get more and more dilute. So I think the answer is to, at least my interpretation of this, is that I have to be looking for new writers, new subject matter, perhaps new ways of looking at older things. Because we, in I Magazine, we feature a lot of historical work, but I'm looking for a new insight, a contemporary insight into something that happened before, maybe to rescue something that's been ignored or misunderstood or just thought as being kitsch or old-fashioned. And so I think it's objectivity and subjectivity actually work very closely together. And sometimes I'm just very much in awe of the quality of writing and research that goes into a piece. Somebody will send me an idea. Well, take, for example, the new issue, which you have there, I number 63. To take the latest issue, we have a 14-page piece about Argentine design by a very nice man, Cesar Cesio, who I met about a year ago. Turned out he was a great fan of the magazine. Also turns out to be a music fan, as many designers are, as we seem to be discovering in this conference. And he had been, he had a friend, an academic back in Buenos Aires called Veronica Deval, who is doing a PhD on post-war Argentine design. And I said, this sounds like a piece for I. And so this began a long process of conversations, of phone calls and emails, to find how we could get the materials, how we could assemble a long piece which covered the history of the design but somehow brought it into up to date, and also had a critical view of Argentine design, because obviously it's a big subject. It's a book that we all, you know, maybe there will be an English language book in a few years. At the moment, most of the books that cover this work seem to be in Spanish and haven't been translated. Maybe some of your listeners will correct me, but that seems to be the case. And there's a critical angle, which is about the influence of European modernism on the designers in Buenos Aires and the way the education system worked, and also the way the education system worked in relation to the political travails of Argentina, with the generals and the Falklands War and all these different things. So we had, I think something that César said to me once in passing was, oh, you know, we had our 60s and the 80s. We had to, you know, we had to wait for the generals to go before we could really have the revolution in graphic design education that happened much earlier elsewhere in the world. So this became a very interesting angle. And of course, we're showing some very nice work. You can immediately see the influence of Swiss modernists and the German modernists and the Italian modernists. And there's also a very interesting exchange between Argentine designers who went to Barcelona, who went to Italy. For me, there's a very, very interesting story. And as I say, I'm in great awe of the amount of work and the amount of attention to detail that César and Veronica put into this piece.
Your personal enthusiasm, which is like obvious for the listeners now, is that a criterion for the articles you put in?
Well, I suppose what I'm often looking for is I'm looking for that degree of enthusiasm in my writers, and then I kind of become a conduit for this. You know, I knew nothing about the influence of modernism on Argentine design, and maybe there's another story about the influence of indigenous South American culture on other aspects of Argentine visual culture, which we don't see here. You know, that would be another story, another writer, another set of research. And again, maybe one of your listeners will call up and say, you've ignored this and this.
Is it almost like, is there a certain order in which you think of a subject and then find the people who write and...
Well, there's an element of serendipity in the way that the magazine works. As I said before, I work 3 days a week. I have a very busy schedule. I mean, just getting a magazine out, just getting this to print, getting it designed, edited, corrected. There's a whole process of a very technical process of just producing a beautifully printed, very nice, interesting, and well-researched magazine. That's a big production process, which I'm very hands-on. I take a big involvement in that. The research and development aspect is perhaps sometimes done in the cracks between the production of the magazine, and sometimes I will actually make a point of looking for a certain kind of story, a certain kind of designer or work. For example, for the next issue, I'm looking for writing on certain kinds of websites. So I'm already sending out emails and making phone calls to people that I think have an expertise in that area. But again, I'm not just saying, you go away and write about X. I'm saying, I'm interested in X, Y, and Z. Tell me if this interests you, and tell me about A, B, and C as well. Or tell me how these things relate to what you're interested in. I think when you ask a journalist to do something about a very specific subject, you can get a very professional result. But I'm looking for more than professionalism.
Mm-hmm. But do you work together closely with Simon Esterson?
Of course,
or,
yes.
But do you come up with ideas together, or is he part of the process?
Simon is very much part of the process, but he also has a very busy practice, very successful editorial design practice in London. So we maybe don't spend as much time hanging out together as I did when I was working with Nick Bell, who is Simon's predecessor as art director of I. But there is also a different... Simon brings a new... I mean, Simon's done 6 issues now. He's brought a new dimension to the design of I, because He has this fantastic background in editorial design in magazines to do with architecture, to do with politics, to do with current affairs. And so he brings this to graphic design in a way which is, I think, has reinvigorated the magazine in a very important way.
And did you pick him as a designer of the magazine?
Well, Simon is a very old friend of the magazine who goes back way before my time. When the magazine was founded, iMagazine was founded in 1990 by Word Search, a publishing company which published an architectural magazine called Blueprint. The founding art director of Blueprint was Simon Esterson. So Simon was one of the, if you like, the godfathers or the godparents of at the birth of I. I was originally art directed by Stephen Coates, who was Simon's assistant on Blueprint. I was first edited by Rick Poyner, who was one of the deputy editors on Blueprint. There's a very interesting family tree.
So it's all a family business.
Now, at various times, I met Simon when I first came to I as managing editor, and we've been through four owners over the years, and whenever there's been a difficult period in the, if you like, the politics or the business side of I, Simon has been a fantastic source of advice. He's been my sounding board for all kinds of things, whether it's printing or paper or some of the editorial and direction of the piece. And he's also, Simon is a very modest person as well. He's and I hope you get to interview him, but you'll find him a very interesting person, but he'll probably want to talk about everything other than his own design. Simon has been a very good contributor to I Magazine over the years. And for example, he wrote a piece about newspaper design several years ago. And when he brought the piece to me and Nick Bell, he came with a set of transparencies, or rather he helped us organise a set of transparencies into a series of spreads, because as a writer he thought in terms of spreads and the art direction. He didn't interfere with Nick's design, but the editorial process was so clear that it became a very easy and nice piece to lay out in the magazine. So that editorial way of thinking is very much part of the way Simon works, and it's a very enjoyable process. The difference is, I guess, that we spend more time on the phone rather than in each other's offices or studios than before. And Simon also has an assistant editor who works, called Jay Prynne, who also works quite closely on the magazine. And in fact, has quite a big role in the cover design of I. Although Jay told me that she doesn't want to become a famous designer, so I shouldn't mention her name.
Type radio.